Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
And I'm Spartacus.
Sorry.
Thank you.
I finally watched that TV show, or a couple of the episodes.
And what episode did you get up to?
Two.
Ah, two. Yeah, I still guess it's a couple.
That would be a couple, yes.
Not a few.
Not a few. Yeah. Good? I just watched the end one, finally, the other day.
Season one?
Yeah, season one. I'd been putting it off for a while.
Why?
Just because it wouldn't have anything else to watch kind of after that.
Oh, I see.
It's kind of like finishing the entire Battletech series for you, you know?
Yeah.
What am I going to read after that?
Wait until you catch cancer for it.
I didn't go that far, but... I don't know. Lyle would probably disagree.
You should. You know that joke is pretty bad because the actor actually died of cancer?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that. Well, hey.
So, anyway, that aside... Well, it was kind of bad, I guess.
It was.
My apologies to the family.
What do you think, Lyle? I'll try and dig us out of this hole.
It took me a moment to adjust.
Hmm.
Once you adjust to the visual style, it's good. I wouldn't say the acting is great.
Right.
Certainly the people that they've cast for the Romans are a lot better than the people that they've cast for the gladiators. But I certainly understand if you're going to be half naked through most of the series, you want somebody with a nice physique.
Right. Someone who fits the visual type.
Right. Yeah. And with the Romans, you could just, since they're clothed,
Mostly.
Yeah.
You and I both have the same. Well,
yeah. You can kind of cast somebody solely on their acting ability.
Right.
It's like watching a play, I suppose, or like a comic book come to life, maybe.
Hmm.
Like as in 300 kind of thing?
It's a lot like 300. I don't know if you've seen the HBO series Rome.
Oh, I have that to watch.
But Spartacus owes more to 300 than it does to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer Rome over Spartacus, though. People are comparing a Game of Thrones to Rome. So both made by HBO, both, you know, have pretty big budgets for television, a nice cast, trying to go for a gritty realism.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to find out what the budgets for both shows were. Because after watching...
$50 million for season one of a Game of Thrones.
Then you know what it was for the season one of Spartacus?
No.
I'd have to check. All right, I'll remember that, though, $50 million. I remember we were talking before about the crowd scenes, at least in Spartacus. And to me, it looked like they did a good job in at least giving the illusion that there were a lot of people.
Lots of pixels?
No, like, I think Lyle said something about it looks CG, and I guess... The shots they do in Spartacus, it looks like a section of what would be a larger crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, really far away shots... They don't really do those. They sort of show the building, right? And then when they're doing like close up on acting,
mm-hmm.
you'll have kind of like a, you know, like a side shot, and you'll only see like enough of the crowd that you have to.
Yeah.
Or then when they show the crowd, it'll be like a section of a crowd. So you don't.
But they show the same crowd. You see, I mean,
should you recognize
people in the crowd?
There they are again.
This is the third time I've seen this person. Now they're happy. Oh, there's that same person in the crowd, sad.
I guess
it's like we're watching their growth as a character, and they're an extra.
I love the way this crowd really develops across the series.
I guess I didn't notice that.
But in Spartacus, I mean, very early on, they kind of established, don't expect to see realistic, gritty environments or combat or action.
Hmm.
Don't expect to see realistic acting. It's going to be as if somebody's on a stage with a fake backdrop. Like when they're in Thrace, that clearly looks fake. And at first you're like, whoa, that looks really odd. But then, oh, that's just the style that they're establishing. Like 300.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get, by the time you get to these gladiatorial games and you've kind of bought into that,
mm-hmm.
whereas a Game of Thrones is trying to be realistic.
I think maybe you've articulated what my problem was with that crowd scene, and I hadn't really thought about it, but I don't know. I think
the tournament in season one of a Game of Thrones could have been done a lot better.
Right.
Because they showed that they could do it within whatever they're trying to establish
within that
series by the Edward Stark execution scene. Spoiler.
But if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
But we figure the book's been out for a while.
A little while, yeah.
Yeah, so in there they did the tight shots. That was good. And they could have done that for the tournament scene better. I don't think they needed to emulate Spartacus just because it was the same kind of same people, same group of, I'm guessing, Australian actors, because everybody seemed to speak with an Australian accent. Mm. Yeah, in Thrace. G'day.
Welcome to Thrace.
Yeah. Oh, I'm Spartacus, mate.
Now I'm Spartacus.
We haven't gotten to that part yet.
Yeah, I if you like 300, I would say, sure, watch Spartacus. It's actually better than 300. And try to do more. There's more outside of just constant fast, slow, and CG.
So I like it.
I'm disappointed that the actor did die, though, because he was really, he's good for that part. Yes. I mean, he's a very beautiful guy, which is what you need.
With a staunch record of heterosexuality.
Yeah. I like the ladies, I'm just saying. I could just recognize.
But if I were.
That's why I'm glad you said it as opposed to me. The listeners would have been like, yeah, well, that's Wayne's.
They would have believed it more. He must be beautiful. He's got the Wayne seal of approval.
I hadn't thought of that. But,
yeah, I guess he went through 2 seasons?
No, he only filmed the first one.
Oh, wow. That is tragic.
Because the first season came out 2010.
Yeah.
And I think they're just now filming the second one that's going to maybe going to start airing in 2012. So I think that's why there was a gap because of. Yeah, the actor's unfortunate death.
Yeah, I could have seen him becoming a bigger star after that series.
That's too bad.
Yeah. And you finally watched Kingdom of Heaven.
Actually, you know what? I'm sure I'd seen it in the theater. Maybe just didn't register. I don't
forgot.
I forgot.
That's a ringing endorsement.
Yeah, I know.
Quite the impact.
I did watch Kingdom of Heaven in preparation for this episode. I watched the 3 hours director's cut. Didn't realize it was 3 hours, you know. So, okay, part one and part two, and said, holy crap, both parts are an hour and a half long, so.
Yeah, it's a movie that doesn't need to be 3 hours.
Yeah.
I think it's to the Crusades what Gladiator is to Rome.
Is it, though?
Well, it's kind of made in that whole vein, that same kind of vein, you know?
Because I was thinking about it, and you just mentioned it. Like, Gladiator kind of, I suppose it does, because you look at it.
The report is historically accurate.
Well, I was thinking, you look at Kingdom of Heaven, you're kind of like, well, they're not exactly painting, you know, Christians in the best light here.
You're right.
And I guess they kind of did that with Gladiator, you know, they're not exactly painting
Romans in the best light.
So I rescind that. But yeah, so.
It's not so much they were portraying Christians in a bad light in the Kingdom of Heaven, it's just that they portrayed them as Muslims in a very positive light.
Anyway, as you said, the movie didn't have to be that long.
And they didn't, they probably didn't have to make Saladin that benevolent.
Right.
I mean, he was as complex as anybody.
Hmm.
So there was examples of great chivalry in history, but also there was examples of cruelty. And like when they took Jerusalem, boiler, he actually made Balian pay for everybody he wanted free, and anybody they couldn't pay for were enslaved.
Hmm.
So it's not as if he said, oh, yeah, you can all go. Oh, okay. Wow, what a great guy. Why did we fight this guy this whole time? And I guess a big difference would be Gladiator had Russell Crowe.
Where?
Kingdom of Heaven had Orlando Bloom.
Yeah, slight difference in the heroics there. I don't know.
But you know, that being said, I didn't disbelieve the fight scenes with Orlando Bloom.
I find it hard to believe anything Orlando Bloom does. It's just kind
of... Well, I'll put it this way. At least it wouldn't slide down the trunk of an elephant in Kingdom of Heaven, all right?
Which would have made it better. My ex-roommate described it pretty well before. He's kind of just a damp squid, which is just such a great image. It's kind of...
That was a bit harsh, but...
I don't know, like, really, he's never been in a scene, he's never done something that makes you go, oh, wow, cool, Orlando Bloom.
Yeah,
I think...
He's kind of pretty and he's there.
No, the first scene I ever saw him in was in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And he has that exchange with Keira Knightley, and clearly he's smitten with her.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he betrayed that.
Hmm.
Everything else!
I suppose it's kind of hard to go on... Like Fellowship of the Ring, when he just plays an elf.
You can have my bow.
Yeah, that's the only line anyone remembers.
And my axe. All right. Are you guys coming with your bow and axe? Oh, no.
I'll give it to you. You can take it.
Here you go. Have fun.
You can have my spare bow. Here you go.
I didn't promise arrows.
But if you'd like to buy some. I get what Wayne's saying. It looks like he worked out and practiced his swordsmanship. He didn't bring a lot of charisma to the role, but he certainly wasn't the weakest link of the movie. It probably did you spot Jamie Lannister?
Yeah, I did. I thought he would be in more scenes, but it was just that one, wasn't it?
Yeah. Was it? What's his name? Nicolaj Coster?
Yeah.
Or Walder Coster? The Danish guy who plays Jaime Lannister in the Game of Thrones. So imagine him as Balian. And you're like, wow, I think they would have kept Jerusalem.
Well, yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Liam Neeson was good in it.
For some reason, I remember him having a longer part in it.
No.
You know, it's like, and all right, Liam Neeson's dead.
Oops, maybe because the first time he saw it wasn't 3 hours long.
Yeah, maybe.
Actually, he did.
Yeah, looking at the rest of the movie, hey, he was there for a long time.
Edward Norton was good in it, even though you never see his face.
He was in it? I'd like, yeah.
He's the guy in the, he's the leper king with the mask. That's Edward Norton.
All right, yeah.
Oh. Did you like the leper king?
You know what?
The leper... Did they cut his part out?
No. The leper king was reminding me I had seen this movie before.
That's great if it is.
He is what reminded me I had seen the movie before. So I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. So,
like, sorry, he's... You didn't remember seeing him.
No.
But seeing him helped you remember that you saw it the first time.
Seeing the character, not the...
Yeah, seeing the character. The Leper King character in the movie. Like, oh, I did see this movie before. All right. Yeah.
Whoever that guy is, he's great.
I thought that was pretty clear. Anyway.
Well, Kingdom of Heaven actually leads into what we're talking about today. We're going to be doing our... We're going to be talking about knights and samurai.
So half lead in. Because there weren't any samurai in Kingdom of Heaven.
Oh, well, then you should have watched the samurai movie, too. And we could have said, oh, well.
And then mashed them together? All right, so I watched the first half of Kingdom of Heaven. Good, good. Then I watched the second half of Ron. Put them together. Yeah, the story didn't make any sense.
So we're doing Knights and Samurai. And we decided to combine them because we see them as essentially the Eastern and Western versions of each other.
Yeah. Pretty similar when you... Start looking at them.
Yeah.
The more you look at them, the more similar it seems.
Yeah.
When we started out, with like the idea of the knights versus samurai, but man, they're...
Oh, are we not going to do that?
It would only be them fighting themselves. How do you defeat yourself?
Yeah, it's like committing suicide or seppuku.
Yeah. Anyway, the more you look at them, it just seems like, as you said, well, they're just kind of Eastern and Western versions of the same thing.
Well, I mean, they weren't really. There's a warrior class and just kind of different societies and trappings around them, but well, I suppose it's pretty different. But anyway, yeah. So
when we talk, about knights and samurai, what are we talking about? I'm sure everybody has an image of what a knight is and what a samurai is.
Well, I guess the classic image of the knight is the mounted, armored warrior with the shield and the longsword and the lance.
And you kind of said Gothic plate armor.
And Gothic plate armor, which actually was, in the 15th century, 16th century. So basically by the time the knights were irrelevant, the armor that you imagine when you watch a movie or that you see when you watch a movie like Excalibur.
I was just thinking that.
Then I think football plates.
Hmm? Then I think football armor, because that's kind of what it looked like a little bit to me.
Oh, okay. All right.
Sorry.
That would actually be the knight basically in their decline. For samurai, we probably think of...
The guy with the katana.
Yeah, the guy with the katana on foot.
Yeah.
Even though they started as a mounted...
Archers.
Mounted archers, the way of the horse, the way of the bow.
Kind of that thick, like, lacquered armor
and
stuff. But again, same as the knight. Like, that image is when they began to decline in the Edo period.
I think you said, Chris, like, in the research we did, the sword only comes out when you run out of arrows.
Well, one of the websites I saw, and it was in Japanese, so that makes it legitimate, said that the sword is, what did it say? I think the translated text was, sword is pulled after injection of the arrows.
Thank you, Google Translate.
Thankfully, my Japanese is good enough that I could figure out what it meant, but...
Or your Japlish.
Japlish
is good enough. But essentially, they're the same thing. Is there... like you said, a warrior class, they're the connected to the upper class, they're both part of a feudal system. Samurai even means, or comes from the verb to serve. So we are going to say that they're pretty much the same thing. And when you play them, there's a lot of similar considerations. But yeah, there are some different considerations as well.
Country.
Which we'll get into today.
I couldn't let that one go, sorry.
One speaks Japanese? All right, so first thing we're going to look at when you your backstory.
Right.
And for the knight, which was a lot easier to find information for, you're looking at, you know, a progression is when you're very young, a young boy, like 8 or 9, you might be sent to another noble family to serve as a page.
Right.
And there you'll learn, like, courtly behavior, how to treat a noble lady, how to serve. Essentially.
A noble lady.
How to please a noble lady.
I was waiting. I was gearing up for that one.
I think you're watching too much Spartacus.
I guess I have.
How do we sex this up a bit?
Actually, that didn't bother me about Spartacus, where it did bother me in Game of Thrones.
Amount of sex?
Yeah. Sorry, I just had to throw that out there.
It bothered you?
In Game of Thrones, yeah, because at least in Spartacus, they didn't really try to convey information during those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in... so I didn't see them trying to, spice up something that the writer saw as boring mm-hmm. with sex scenes in Spartacus, where that they seemed to do that in Game of Thrones.
Was the sex scene used for character development?
I honestly don't really know what it was used for other than nudity.
There's just a lot of flesh in Spartacus.
Right.
Sorry, taking a break from backstory. There's a lot of flesh in Spartacus. Yeah, there's not a lot of sex position as there is in a Game of Thrones. Probably it doesn't stand out as, or it comes across as less jarring than in Game of Thrones. Probably because...
I think possibly you get used to it.
No, it's not so much, maybe. But also you read a Game of Thrones or the Song of Ice and Fire series and you realize there's not as much sex in the book as there is in the TV series, so you notice when it's added in more.
Absolutely, yeah. You're going to the story. When Littlefinger gave this exposition, there weren't two naked ladies banging each other.
Right. Yeah. And we never, yeah. And when you give a prostitute who's not in the book a lot of lines, a lot of political savvy. Right.
Education.
Yeah, education.
All right, we're getting into angry territory, Wayne.
All right. Stands out. All right. Also, when we think about Rome, we think about a certain decadent period in history. So it's easy to spice that up, even though it is the Republic. So I think that would be less decadent than Imperial Rome. But still, our image is people in togas, nudity.
Right.
Yeah. People in togas and people not in togas.
People half in a toga.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
All right.
So back to backstory.
So after that,
long
after starting as a page and then serving a little bit of time in the gladiatorial arena,
then getting naked and you're all set. That's how one becomes a knight.
I guess to tie it back in, you did learn to fight as possibly not a page, but then as a squire.
I was tying it in, dude.
All right, sorry. Didn't mean to jump the shark. Go ahead.
Then you get into squires.
Oh, is that how it goes?
So you become a squire, not a gladiator, is what you're trying to say? Sorry.
So what happens after Paige?
You become a book.
Well, the Spartacus route was very rare for the knight, so usually it went Paige to squire. Where then they would learn how to fight, how to do acrobatics, wrestling, archery, hunting. And what we found out is the squire system actually came about a little bit later, maybe about the 13th century, whereas prior to that, the squire was more of a lower class. And a squire pretty much, it comes from a French word meaning shield bearer. So you're kind of like a servant, an assistant to the knight.
So do you think...
As opposed to a knight in training.
So do you think the idea of a squire, sort of the more upper class, kind of essentially trading their kids, do you think that kind of came around when chivalry kind of started to take on a little bit?
Oh, because of the page? I could see a lot of connections between chivalry and the page duties, certainly.
Well, that's what I mean in the terms of learning how to act at court.
Yeah.
Or learning how to, behave in front of women as opposed to what it was before, where it was just kind of lower class, you're a servant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that might be something to think about.
Yeah, I suppose it could be. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of I don't know, what did we find with the samurai?
I don't know.
Yeah.
A whole lot of I don't know. Yeah.
There actually wasn't much information around that we could find.
How someone goes from being a child to being a samurai.
Yeah. Of course, in the later eras, it was just with the knights, is that it was cased, So if your parents are the warrior class, your son is going to be. But the actual training part, the only thing I could think of was Satsuma area in southern Japan. They followed the quote-unquote traditional ways for a really long time. And they called it the old samurai way, but I don't know if it's actually true or not. But what that was is where the master would teach the oldest student, and then that student would teach someone younger, and then that person would teach someone younger down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's actually what they did, but that's what some people claim to have done.
So when making a character, I think an important thing to consider is the connections. I suppose a samurai to a particular school, although I'm wondering if that came much later
right.
in the samurai period. But for knights, definitely, you can establish ties to another noble family. Maybe there is a hostage, maybe there to train as a page or a squire. You have a connection to another knight.
Hmm.
Or you can even do that if we're going to take the Satsuma example as being true, is then you would have a connection to whoever was above you and that person was trained you. Now, it could have been a positive relationship, could have been a negative relationship, but there is a relationship that's not necessarily familial.
Yeah. One thing reading Game of Thrones taught me is they seem to, like, trade kids left, right, and center.
That's fairly realistic, isn't it?
I would imagine so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes sense because it just, as Lyle said, it builds up relationships that are not necessarily familial.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's also kind of just kind of like insurance, like you said, trading hostages.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's what Tokugawa did. Is he brought the wives of all of his vassals into Tokyo to keep them there so that they wouldn't rebel?
Yeah, hostages you find all throughout history.
Yeah. Huh. Just something to think about when you're building your knight and or samurai character.
Exactly. Take some hostages.
Or maybe, yeah, but wouldn't you do that after you became a knight? I could see this little. So when my guy was a page, he took his first hostage. Like, really?
Well, you're asking how to become a knight.
Well, yeah.
I have a sword and a hostage. I am a knight.
Okay, now we're gonna look at
smooth.
Don't blame the person trying to make the transition. Blame the person who became before.
Oh, yeah, I admit.
How am I supposed to smooth that over?
All right, hostages. So,
And hostages brings us to our first era. No, it actually doesn't. So we're going to also highlight different eras in which to play a knight and samurai.
Which we said was the Crusades.
Yes. So from, I don't know, about 1085 to 1095, there's different ideas of when the Crusades started.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whether it was started in Spain, you know, when they're starting to take back Spain from the Muslims, or when they're actually going into the Holy Land. Mm. The Holy Land, the Middle East.
What was wrong with saying the Holy Land?
I don't know. It just sounded kind of archaic to say it. Uh-huh. Yeah, but I don't know.
Because talking about knights and samurai is so futuristic or modern.
Spain could be the Holy Land too.
No, it's all holy. God gave us all this land, so it's all, I don't know. Yeah, and there's a few reasons why the Crusades would be a good place to either set your game in or even to draw inspiration from.
Because there's lots of fighting.
Well, yeah, there's lots of fighting. Oh, did I say, I meant reason, that
there's
was
more than one?
Yeah. Well,
there's
a lot of fighting going on.
You do those talkie campaigns, don't you?
But as Chris
have
said,
been in one of my campaigns. Jeez, sorry.
Sorry, go on.
But as Chris
said, stink eye. And I'm going to get it again.
Because that's
oh, that's grand.
Because as Chris said, we see knights fighting a different culture, even though the Muslims did have their own equivalent of a knight. Mm-hmm. But they're fighting in a different environment, the desert. They're also fighting in a culture has a different style of fighting.
Mm.
Maybe light horsemen who will flee and then, you know, do the feigned retreat. Another reason is that with the Crusades, we see the establishment of the religious orders, the Templars, the Hospitallers. So then we have like monastic knights.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know as much about the history of knights as I do on the other side of it. Were knights before that very heavily religious?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's how the Templars started, is a couple knights wanted to become monks.
Mm-hmm.
After the First Crusade.
But they didn't want to stop cutting people.
No, they just wanted to become full-on monks, and they were asked because of the manpower shortage in they call it Altrimmer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be what we consider the Middle East, like Syria and Israel. Basically, the Crusader lands.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a manpower shortage, and they knew that when the Muslims got reorganized and came back, you know, they would need people to fight. So they convinced these pious knights to become not just monks, but an actual monastic military order.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the Templars started. The Hospitallers actually started a little bit before the Templars, and they established like hospitals and poorhouses. And one of the roles of both the Hospitallers and the Templars was to protect the pilgrims traveling to the Holy Land.
Not if you watch Kingdom of Heaven.
No. Yeah. They would cut down the pilgrims.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not very nice.
It's a hatchet job, that movie.
Yeah. And how about over for the samurai? Since you said, Chris, you knew more about what's going on over there.
Well, around that time we picked the...
Okay, thank you, Chris.
It's all good.
Sorry, I had to do that joke. All right.
The Genpei War.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we looked at the two big samurai families of the Minamoto and the Taira. And they fought for supremacy. And this is when we start to see the decline of the empire. And what was interesting about that era is we have like the rustic Minamotos fighting the imperial Taira.
It's also a good era because you have the Sōhei as well, the warrior monks
in Japan. Yeah.
But unlike the Templars, they were against the warrior classes.
Yeah, they would join either one, whichever one.
So what did they do? They fought to not fight. kind of defeats the purpose of not fighting.
Yeah, no, they'd be like a wild card, so they would join either side. But even if you were just completely to ignore the history there, but take that idea of having an imperial. Almost would be considered even effeminate group of samurai who are all about being, they were men of letters, the men of the arts. Mm. They would even adopt some of the imperial customs such as blackening their teeth.
Right.
And I still don't know why that became fashionable.
Because apparently teeth are ugly.
Apparently, yeah.
Or either that they were all half rotted anyway, so they just said, you know what, we'll just cover them all up.
It could be, yeah. It's like, I really prefer to see like somebody with all their teeth knocked out, but I just can't commit. So maybe I'll blacken the teeth. Yeah. And then on the other side, then you have like, the rough country samurai of the Minamotos.
Mm-hmm. Who had all their teeth.
Yeah. Well, that's one way they could tell it apart.
They didn't black the real ones.
There's one instance where he didn't know who it was until he could see the guy's teeth and saw that they were black. And he's like, he's opposed me. Yeah.
Either that or he's just some poor guy with all his teeth.
There's one of his own. He's your own man.
No, really, I'm not imperial.
He just likes honey.
Just didn't put in his dentures today.
No. Jeez. Yeah, and as Chris said, then you also have that third wild card. That third group, and you have to woo them, and because they are the Sōhei, I'd say they're not as this might not be the greatest thing to say, but I would say as far as from a Christian perspective, we wouldn't see them the Sōhei as religious or as with the same type of piety as we would when we would expect from like the church in Europe at the time, and that they were. Yeah, you could woo them with very temporal incentives.
Mm-hmm. Money.
Money.
It's money.
Yeah.
Which well, is, I mean,
did I dance around that?
Wasn't the church kind of like that too, a little bit?
Well.
With gifts of like land and money.
The thing, not en masse though. Like the Sōhei. Yeah. I mean, you could sway the entire sect pretty easily.
Rather than bribing, say, one person.
Right.
I guess so. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, even though like the Templars and the Hospitallers are answerable to the church, they're a kind of a separate thing. Whereas these guys would like live in the actual temples, not like special their own castles.
Yeah.
So is that when we kind of had the emergence of what more sword based combat for samurai?
No, they were still used a lot of...
Horse and bow.
Horse and bow. There's a funny... or the naginata, the kind of like the...
The long pole arm.
Yeah, long pole arm.
Just sounds cool.
There's a story of like a monk, actually, who walks on the... I think it's called the Yuji Bridge. Mm. And he spins the naginata.
Knocks all the arrows out.
Yeah, he's called the Tajima arrow, the arrow cutter. And he just spins his naginata and cuts all the arrows that are coming towards him.
Kind of makes you wonder why they didn't just go around and shoot from the back.
Yeah. Actually, that's how they pretty much, it was like a classic, like 300, you know, where they blocked the pass, but because it was just
this
a bridge.
Movie is called One.
Yeah. Brother, me!
Sorry, go ahead.
But they pretty much just figured out, it's just, oh, why don't we just cross it and ford the river?
That's a pretty boring movie. Yeah. He holds a bridge. All right, screw that guy. We'll just find another bridge. Yeah, what do you think about that?
Actually, they just forded the river. So it's like,
they didn't even use
need
the bridge.
That guy's dangerous. Screw that.
Okay. I can see that. He's like, wait a minute. Why is there even a bridge here? Like, the river is like really shallow. How about we just walk across?
Hey, look, I figured out if we take off our boots. And then put them on the other side. It's like we didn't even walk across.
Can't stare with the knock and hey, come on. I practiced all week.
That sounds pretty dishonorable, I guess, to do that, which is perhaps why they crossed the bridge. You know?
Well.
But it didn't even sound like they're trying to cross. They just like shot arrows at one guy. So.
Well, the Genpei War was at the end of the Han. That was kind of before there was the whole Bushido code, before it got really stuck in. Hmm.
But that is funny because. And you're right, but then when the samurai then would look back on like the Genpei War or the 9-year war, like these early samurai conflicts, and they would idolize what they saw as very individual one-on-one combat because
such
of course
one guy with a naginata
versus the army.
Yeah, what they didn't tell you is when they looked back, they kind of rewrote it.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a whole army holding the bridge. But they're like, yeah, you know what? That's not epic enough. Let's change it to one guy. And you know how he got shot down? No, that's not cool. Have him spin the naginata, block all the arrows. Now that's cool. That's probably what happened.
So, his real name is Tajima Pincushion.
Harisenbo.
Nice one. So,
all right.
Anyway, that just kind of brings us to the what. So kind of like we said in the beginning, samurai was actually the way of the horse and bow at that time.
Mm, yeah. I mean, the whole warrior class, that was the mounted warriors. It was weird that it kind of evolved opposite way of Europeans. And,
I'm just thinking if you're going to like draw on that time period for your samurai character, you wouldn't be a swordsman. You'd probably put more points or more feats into archery. And horseback riding.
Well, that would be the way of it, yeah.
Whereas, I guess the knights at that time would be more, well, obviously horseback or riding, and they would probably be melee fighters.
Right, absolutely.
I guess that doesn't really change along the knight lines, you know?
It is an important distinction, is that we see an evolution of the samurai from mounted to foot, and from missile to melee, but knight, we don't see like their role changing as much. We see their equipment and the armor and their weapons changing or constantly in conflict, but we don't, they always tried to be the mounted soldier.
Right.
Because it was very much, like, they would look down on the foot soldier.
This may be getting ahead a little bit, but you brought up that knight equipment changes.
Yes.
And you said it was really hard to kind of pick a quote-unquote like knight weapon or, you know, knight equipment just because it constantly evolves and you can't really pick one thing saying this would be the quintessential equipment. But like a samurai, they kind of, their armor kind of not stagnated but just kind of stopped after a while and just said like, no, this is the equipment that a samurai would kind of have.
Yeah, you could probably divide the samurai into like two phases, two general phases. Sorry, historians out there, but yeah, what Chris said, the yoroi armor and the bow and being mounted, and then kind of more of the domaru, the more like a breastplate with the sword and the gun and like those two distinct eras. Mm-hmm. Whereas, the knight is a constant
just kind of like retooling of the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. There's a really good article by John Clements, and he was comparing The Knight and the Samurai, and it was in Dragon magazine. And yeah, he said it was really tough, like even comparing the sword, the long sword versus the katana, because at a certain point, yeah, as Chris said, the sword, the tachi started as like a really more curved, a little bit shorter, and then it evolved into what we would now think is the katana. And then it kind of, yeah, sure, it was refined, but it still kind of stayed the same sword, whereas the knight sword always, even the long sword, there was like many different versions, and one was good for armor, one was good for
an unarmored
guy, one was good for piercing, one was good for slashing. So they didn't necessarily have that one utility sword.
Which made a lot of sense. I mean, they were fighting much more heterogeneous kind of foes compared to the samurai who were fighting each other, mostly.
Yeah. And that is a good point, is that, yeah, you could ritualize the combat a bit more if you're just fighting each other. Like the Greeks. When Greeks are fighting Greeks, yeah, they could establish a real hoplite ritual with the phalanx. But then once you start fighting others, then you have to adapt. And the knights never really had that luxury of... Well, they can just take it easy in warfare and...
Oh, man, we're only fighting ourselves.
let's make it fun and establish some rituals.
Mix this stuff up.
I think what kind of makes, at least as a way to distinguish knights from other warriors, which was just codes.
Yep.
I was going somewhere with that.
Okay, well, Bushido then. It was kind of fell into three different phases for it. And early Bushido was a really loose code. And I think it was just about being honorific and loyal and benevolent. But then as it went on later towards the Edo period, they kind of actually codified it down to a way to live. And let's see, the tenets were rectitude, courage, benevolence, respect, honesty, honor, loyalty. And those are really similar to the European ones, right?
Oh, yeah, chivalry kind of just kind of started around the 12th century, and it kind of got codified as just duties to countrymen and fellow Christians, duties to God and duties to women, but kind of very similar.
Yeah.
It's sort of not the same thing.
Well, the thing that I thought was pretty interesting was how kind of the end game was different between them. Like, chivalry was kind of a code about how to live your life well, whereas Bushido was, I'm sure, with the Hagakure, the samurai are always supposed to meditate on death, so it's how to prepare yourself for a good death. Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Might lend itself to how to play either a knight or a samurai. I mean...
I'm of two minds with that, because on the one hand, you want to say, how do you distinguish a knight and a samurai from a regular soldier, warrior?
Right.
Fighter, and you say, oh, it's because of the Bushido or the code of chivalry. But then they didn't really follow it. It existed, or at least in the code of chivalry. It was very, existed while knights were still relevant. Bushido, you could argue that they started to codify it when the samurai were a class that no longer fought and just kind of reflected back on history. And it's like how to maintain their martial virtue and their character. When they're actually...
not relevant.
Well, yeah, they aren't relevant anymore, and their skills are in decline. I think it adds a nice flavor, is technically they should have, and it's a, and it could be used against them. You could say that somebody was like unchivalrous and used in a certain way, like in the courts, or like, let's say in Europe, it could be an embarrassment. But when the king is like butchering peasants and women and, old folk left and right,
it's count.
Yeah, well, obviously, there was a reason for it, or something.
Or something.
Or when you have, like, the samurai would, you know, the do-or-die philosophy, and if I fail, I'll kill myself, then you have all those examples of samurai fleeing the battlefield because they've lost. Then you're like, well, but I mean, it's the same. Everybody's got, you have your ideals, you know, the ideal of courage. You know, the Greeks had their ideal of courage, and then... there's all these examples of, well, the battle's lost, I'm going to run away.
Well, I suppose
what
it
about
in...
courage? Yeah, what about it?
Can't hear you. I'm running away. Yeah. You know, I suppose it really depends on how you want to build your character, you know? If you want to make it more kind of the fantastic guy, then, yeah, throw in those ideas of codes you have to follow.
One thing I am of one mind is have it, but how to play it. Like, have it in existence
right.
in the society or in the world, but whether or not people actually follow it, I'm not sure if you should really enforce like how much it's followed versus how much is ignored. Even like, for example, the Templars, and they're not exactly a code of chivalry. They have their own code, but they're very religious. Mm-hmm. They would make deals with the people we would call the assassins or other Muslims and that, just because it was politically expedient and it was better to make a deal with the Templars and the assassins would have a common entity in I believe, Saladin. So why not? You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Mm-hmm. So that kind of real politic would exist even with the Templars. So in your world, how realistic you want it to make it is, if it's somewhat realistic, then real politics has to play a role. And another trapping that could add a unique flavor to your Knight of Samurai is the idea of heraldry, or what the Japanese would call mon. Generally, it would be like a circle with, they really like that floral motif. I mean,
the chrysanthemum?
The imperial mon is the chrysanthemum.
Yeah, I've seen cranes, I've seen just raindrop shapes, sickles.
The Christian samurai would have crosses, so they were easy to spot. And they would tend to put those on flags or little banners.
That makes sense.
And on roof tiles.
Oh, yeah, on the roof tile.
Which they didn't carry into battle.
No.
Take that!
I was thinking chucking the roof tile, too.
Where did the roof tiles come from?
But I think
riveting conversation there. What is this? We're talking about Knight Samurai and roofing.
You only have yourself to blame on that one. Listen to the A Song of Ice and Fire role playing game. They have a really good heraldry system, or at least generator. You know, a way to generate it, and it was actually really useful because they use the correct terms for what everything is, and I'm drawing blanks on them now, but you know, if you have like an animal on there, whether it's rampant or whatever the other one is, I forget, you know, you could find out, I'm really selling this, aren't I? If you can find out
what
a bend, a sinister is, or so they actually do use all the
correct terms. I mean, there's so many different terms, like you break down the shield as chief, fess, charge, field, base, and since it's a podcast and not a visual medium, there's no point even saying it's this part.
Yeah.
But no, it's just to really say that A Song of Ice and Fire, and in particular this writer, because I've seen him do other stuff on knights for D20. I'm pretty sure he wrote the knight in the Player's Handbook too.
Wow, he's got a lot of consonants in his name.
And Robert J. Schwab. And he also wrote a book called Cavalier for the 3.5 system by Green Ronin. And it is really good. On just how to play like your fantasy knight. And I think really A Song of Ice and Fire is just kind of the culmination of all his expertise. Mm-hmm. And it's real solid work.
I've tried making a family crest, or not a family crest, but like a house crest.
Yeah, so did I. It came out really boring.
Me too. Like,
but no, sorry, you can randomly roll.
It's random rolls. Because you don't, if you pick it, you feel kind of cheesy. You're like, oh, well, I'm going to pick something cool. Like, you know, like the lion on green and gold and all the stuff. And then you're like,
a dragon with a lion in its mouth.
So what'd you end up with? Like a rock?
No, it was just kind of like, I think I got like green and silver were my two colors. The design was just kind of like a triangular one. Either that or the shield within a shield. And I forget what kind of emblem I got, but the fact that I forgot it says a lot. You know, it wasn't anything cool.
Boring.
Like, yeah, it was kind of like, oh, I guess I'll go with this.
So it was kind of a rock.
Hey, stone. All right. But I think you could definitely use. We had talked about that before, and if you do use the heraldry, then it adds something more, because then you could figure out. There's a lot of, role playing things you can do with it, because now you know who is from what house and what family people belong to, and. I just thought it leads a lot to it, because, you know, then you wouldn't have to, you wouldn't have to have players ask, well, you would have players ask who works for who or who's affiliated with who, but it would be a way to kind of show it rather than just have the players remember. They would remember, oh, you know, three dogs on a yellow field, you know, they're a part of this house or.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Anytime you have the players kind of be able to pull their own knowledge into something, it increases the immersion. Yeah, it's good.
I also thought it was a kind of a way to make other skills useful. You know, either history or some kind of knowledge.
Heraldry.
I don't know how to make a heraldry 10 points skill, in a heraldry. But at least like history would be a way to do it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that would be
it
good.
It depends how important it would be. In our next era, we're looking at two big invasions. One is the Mongol invasion or attempted invasion of Japan in 1274 and 1281. It's a very good era for the samurai. And of course, it has, that's where we get the idea of kamikaze, the divine wind that saved Japan. And for the knights, we look at the Hundred Years' War, where England invaded France, essentially, and the wars that took place there.
I guess as we kind of said before, I imagine that the samurai equipment would still be kind of similar to previous eras.
Well, that was actually,
not necessarily. They were actually losing. It was mostly the Kyushu samurai, and they were their archery skills had gone in decline already. So even then, they're starting to switch to more hand to hand weapons.
But it's interesting that you bring that up because the Mongolian War was a pretty big turning point as far as samurai equipment went. Because it was the first time that they'd gone against soldiers that had a different kind of armor than what they were used to. The Mongolians had, I think it was studded leather, was it?
Pretty much, yeah.
And they found that the tips of the swords were breaking against that kind of armor. So they had to completely redesign the at least the front end of the katana. And that was, it was a big shock to them.
Yeah, our supreme sword can't cut through studded leather.
Take that, all you fanboys.
Yeah.
There's something to think of when you look in your book and you're like, oh, katana, look at all the sharpness. Like, no.
And they also encountered an army that didn't believe in ritualized one-on-one combat.
Well, it's like, whoa, hold on, those guys are going to mob me? Whoa. These guys are fighting for real.
They're fighting to win? What's this?
Fighting to win, not fighting for show.
One at a time, please.
Take a number.
I can see that. Form orderly line.
They try to do that bridge trick again, and the Mongols just burn the bridge. It's like, hold on. They also encountered, like, siege weapons. So the Mongols had, like, some sort of, kind of like a proto-bomb, where I don't know exactly what it was, but it's a round, fiery ball that exploded. Like a bomb.
It's very bombish, like, yes.
Bomb. Yeah. Had all the bomb characteristics. And the Hundred Years' War, we're looking at where the knights the French knights, and they encounter the English longbow for the first time. I never really learned that you should not charge the British archers or the English archers. But so we start to see at that time the knights in decline. So, you know, contrast that where when the Normans invade England and we see the dominance of the knight and how it's superior to what is around, especially like the foot soldiers. Now we see where the foot soldiers are starting to regain their supremacy of the battlefield and how they do that. And basically the Hundred Year War starts with the longbow being dominant and ends with the cannons being dominant in 1453.
And the knights just kind of go from bad to worse then.
Yeah. Become increasingly more irrelevant.
Yeah.
The same thing kind of happened over in Japan. But
for another 100 years.
Yeah. No, I guess it seems to me like Japan kind of put like I guess they kind of stopped the evolution, you know? Whereas I guess in Europe, the knights kind of eventually went out of decline because of these advancements.
Right.
Whereas in Japan, it's kind of like, whoa, we kind of see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And we're going to stop that.
Well, the thing is, in Europe, you couldn't. Because Europe was all these different cultures. It was open. Yeah. The Mongolians, well, we talked about the Mongolians, and the Japanese didn't really stop the Mongolians.
A typhoon did.
Yeah, typhoon stopped it both times.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, divine.
So they were more isolated, and then the Mongolians just gave up. But the Mongolians could sweep in through Russia and into Europe.
That was the thing. It was like the decline of the knight, the warrior class in England was because of superior technologies gained for the infantrymen. In Japan, they just had a long, long period of peace where the economics became much more important than warfare.
And the fashionable knight at this time would be wearing some plate armor. We start to see the mace becoming more dominant because swords, once plate armor was introduced, the sword was kind of useless against that. So we're seeing different types of swords, like the two-handed sword, which you could grip and drive it like a spear.
I believe you call that the Conan-style sword.
Not exactly, but you know, in the Conan sword in the movie Conan, where just above the cross guard, there's a blunted blade.
Yeah.
It's part of the blade, but it's blunted. It doesn't have an edge to it, and that's so Conan, or not Conan, so a knight could use one hand below the cross guard and one hand above the cross guard for a better grip.
Use like a spear.
Yeah, like I said, like a spear.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the mace, because the mace could like bash through.
Yeah, why cut armor when you can just pulp whatever's underneath it?
Well, that was the point. The armor was getting so advanced at that point that you couldn't cut through it, so there wasn't much of a point.
And a lot of game systems, I don't think, do a good job of conveying how effective the mace is against armor.
I remember old D&D 3.5 had that. It had slashing, piercing, and bludgeoning damage.
Mm-hmm.
And different armor was more or less effective against different types. So they had a little bit of that, but...
But a lot of times, yeah, you look at a mace and it's just like, oh, it's just got less or equal damage to the sword, yeah. But there's no real distinction. And I know people don't want to overcomplicate something, but...
I don't know, man. When I've seen those, like, morning stars with the spikes sticking out of a big weighted ball, I think that looks like one of the most vicious weapons I've ever seen. Because I can just imagine that being driven right into your skin.
Right, so why don't most game systems reflect that?
Hmm. Yeah.
That's the question, you know?
It's a hard balance, you know? You have this big list of weapons, and then you have the big list of armor. Do you really want to go through each one? It's hard to make a smooth system doing all that.
I think the keywords was the way to go for Song of Ice and Fire. Because they're easy. Keywords that you can get.
Hmm.
Like, right. You can understand.
Kind of like we said in A Time for War, there's always kind of that evolution, I guess. And like we said, why do some fantasy games have wildly different tech among the cultures? Because honestly, what would happen is whatever tech is best would just kind of take over.
Disseminate through them all.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So yeah. I guess I can kind of see from a game design standpoint, you don't want to obsolete any weapon. You know, you want to give a variety and things,
yeah.
Things have to be balanced. Otherwise, everybody's going to say, hey, you know what? I'm not going to take the longsword. I'm going to take the mace because the mace kicks ass. And then...
what was the knight and samurai like out of combat?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so... Yeah, actually, I was really surprised by this. Like, when looking into it, just how much extra combat things they studied. Like, for knights...
How much extra as in non-combat?
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Sorry.
I was like, how much extra combat things they studied as in what? Like, man, they were trained in all this kind of combat stuff.
Yeah, sorry. I was being unclear. But knights were often trained in hunting and falconing and courtly thingamajiggies, like...
Is that the technical term?
Being in court. Thingamajiggies.
So if I look at my character sheet, it'll say courtly thingamajiggies.
Stuff my dudes.
Rank 5.
That kind of stuff, yeah.
So you just said all the stuff outside of combat that they get trained in, and then you just hand wave all of that.
That's what I was thinking.
Because hunting.
Sorry, will you please break down courtly duties then for us?
It would just be like etiquette.
Like dancing.
And?
Yeah, like falconry, hunting, dancing.
Courtly thingamajigs.
Courtly behavior.
Thanks. Linguistics, that was pretty...
That was the one
surprising.
I was going to bring
up. Of necessity,
up.
Yeah.
Yeah, because as we kind of mentioned, at least in Europe, the knights at least came into contact with many different cultures.
Mm.
So they would, by necessity, as Lyle said, at least have to speak probably a number of different languages.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not all of them. Whereas if you go over to like the samurai... There was a much higher, at least, literacy rate.
Well, yeah, that also really surprised me.
Which is kind of surprising.
Yeah, especially because they studied language, but not necessarily reading and writing.
Right. So I guess a way to differentiate your characters, like a knight, a European-style knight, would probably speak more languages, at least have a better linguistic skill,
mm-hmm.
whereas like a samurai would be more literate, but probably would only speak one language.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. Again, the homogenous culture, there wasn't really that necessity. But especially with literacy, the samurai were expected to study calligraphy and poetry as well.
Mm-hmm. Tea ceremony was very popular.
Yeah.
You got to read the instructions to do that.
Yeah.
Or not. Just tie it to literacy. All right, I'm failing.
Maybe flower arranging.
I think one of you two said it was the knights more outward. And... The samurai is more inward. And I don't want to say like introvert, extrovert.
Right.
But yeah, the things that the knight did were very open, very social. What the samurai did was, poetry was social. Tea ceremony was social. It was more quiet, reflective.
Pensive, meditative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to the loud, drunken parties the knights would have.
Dancing's not very terribly pensive, I suppose. quiet, reflective dancing.
Falconing is.
I think emo came centuries after knights. Or emo.
emu. I believe they had emu.
They're riding horses, but that's a much better image.
You know what? Now I just had this image of like all these guys in plate armor standing by themselves, just in different corners of the Great Hall, kind of doing like this slow shuffle of...
It's like prom all over again.
Yeah. Emo knight.
Summer's, I'm so not going to conform to this.
Armor so heavy.
I'm just going to paint it black.
So this leads us into actual combat. And we've kind of touched a lot on that already when we talk about the different eras and how relevant or irrelevant the knight or samurai was on the battlefield, but there are some important distinctions between the two. Mm-hmm. So that's what we want to focus on here. And one was the distinction of beheading and ransoming. So beheading was just very common among the samurai.
Perhaps that's why they almost didn't like have those giant plates, you know, protecting the neck.
Yeah, by that time you're defeated, they just take it all off.
I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy because you read these stories where they capture hundreds of people and they just sit them in a line and just chop, chop, chop. Seems such a waste of life.
Or even like thousands. You know, the stories after a battle where they'll review the thousands of heads that they have. It seems like a waste. Just a waste of manpower.
Yeah, really?
Couldn't you kind of convince them to come to your side and you have more soldiers?
Come to my side and we won't behead you.
No.
I'd take that deal.
Yeah, who wouldn't take that deal?
But then you look at the kidnapper ethos of the knight, where they would just, they would ransom anybody. They would kidnap a guy and ransom him. Of course, you get more money for a noble, but you could ransom like a plowman. Someone would pay something for that.
You had said something interesting before, Lau, where you could essentially sell prisoners to people on your own side. Because if you managed to capture someone that was of a higher rank than you, you would have less of a chance of dealing with the person on the other side to get
the guy that could pay,
right? The guy could pay. So you'd, I don't know what you would call it, but you'd sell the prisoner to the guy higher up. You'd sell him up the ladder.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, there was examples of like where Henry V is making an investment in prisoners, so he would buy them from the troops or the knights.
See that.
So he could sell them to the king on the other side.
It's like, man, I hope this guy bought is the what they. I said that wrong. I hope this prisoner I just bought is really who he says he is. Otherwise, I'm losing money on that investment.
Yeah.
It's like, holy crap, you told me you were the prince of such and such, and really you're just like a lousy plowman.
But the beheading culture is funny because there's one example. And apparently it's a nice story about beheading.
Yeah.
Where I think this is in the Genpei Wars, where I think the Miyamotos are winning this particular battle, and they see one of the Taira fleeing on a horse. So the guy calls him back and says, come back, you know, come back and fight me. So the guy turns around, even though he could have gotten away, dismounts, and they fight. And the Minamoto beats him. And during the unhelmeting or the unmasking, samurai sometimes wore like a mask. He sees it as just a 16-year-old boy. So, wow, this brave 16-year-old boy who came back to fight him, and he beats him. And then he notices that there's all these other Minamoto samurai coming. And he doesn't want to turn the boy over to them because he knows they'll just behead him and treat him roughly. So he beheads him himself. You're like, what?
How touching.
Yeah.
But what they don't tell you in the story is he beheaded him with love.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to cruelty, what the other guys would have beheaded him with.
Yeah, well, what were they going to do that was going to be behead him with a dull knife or something?
I don't know. Jeez.
You see, this sword, this katana here, this is my killing katana. This katana here is my beheading katana. See how dull and rusty it is?
I respect you so much. I'm going to behead you with my good sword.
Yeah, that's essentially.
This is my katana.
Not going to turn you over to these.
This one's for shooting. This one's for fun.
Probably what was going through his head is, no, they're not going to get this head. This head's mine. I earned it.
Probably. I don't have a 16-year-old head in my collection yet.
Oh, gross.
That's something that are 16 years old, but...
It's always been a gap in my collection. It goes 14, 15, 17.
Gotta get them all.
I'm just glad you said it first.
But I think that gets into what Chris said way at the beginning is, you know, the kind of, not saying that life is cheap for the samurai, but it's certainly a different idea on, you know, you prepare yourself for death versus you prepare yourself for life.
Mm.
Right. I suppose, or rules for death as opposed to rules for life.
Just different ways. Not different ways. Probably how you should look at it.
Well, there is no shame in death.
Mm-hmm. Or there is no shame in selling somebody.
No, there's no shame in kidnapping someone, and selling them up to the own side so that they can make money.
That's not shame, that's profit.
Exactly. Right. There's no shame in profit.
Yeah. It's just from our modern eyes, we see that as kidnapping is wrong.
Oh, man, you know what? I could just see, like, someone playing a knight in the game now, you know, and he's just going to be like, okay, is the guy down to, like, one hit point? Yeah, okay. I kidnap him. Oh, come on, again?
You know, like, you've got 20.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, how many of these guys do you have to ransom? He's like, I'm a knight.
I can just see that he's kind of like at the cart with all the prisoners on it, whereas the samurai character has the cart full of heads.
And in the D&D fantasy, but it's like, man, the guy's a goblin. Who are you going to ransom him to? Well, you never know. You've got to keep him to make sure. He's got a family. He's a goblin. He's got a huge family. Someone's going to pay.
You know, the enemies could use that against them. It's like, well, my family owns gold mine.
Yeah, I can do that. Keep talking.
All right. Well, on that note. So as you can see, I think you have a lot of fun playing a knight or samurai.
Behead or ransom. Which one do you choose? That's what it boils down to, isn't it?
Yes.
If there's anything you learn from this podcast, it should be that.
Why it took us an hour to get to that point, I don't know. So we'll just leave you on that.
Thanks for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idledredhands.com, idleredhands.com. Listen to us on Stitcher, through iTunes, or on DriveThruRPG. Comment in the forums, on the page, or on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you. And thanks as always for listening.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Oh,
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.